Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Ireland men's rugby coach and Lions coach Andy Farrell, good morning.
Good morning, Brendan. How are you doing?
Good, thanks. Andy, you've written your autobiography. It's called The Only Way I Know. And it's a fascinating book. Having read it, I'm thinking you're possibly not relishing sitting here talking about it for the next half an hour. Yeah. Shyness nearly stopped you from playing rugby as a kid, didn't it?
Well, it did. It definitely did. I mean, that's so long ago now. I think the development is quite vast to where I am at this moment in time. But as a kid, I was definitely shy enough. Probably a mummy's boy, I would have thought.
Yeah, and a kind of a home bird.
Yeah, definitely a home bird. The place where I come from, Wigan, there's not that many people move out of Wigan, you know, or venture out of Wigan or go on holiday that far from Wigan. You know, if we travel an hour down the road, we feel that's hundreds of miles away, you know. So we tend to stick very close to the family nature and the town itself.
Yeah, because you do say in the book, whatever I do outside of Wigan is because of what that place means to me.
It does, yeah, that's true.
What does it mean to you?
It means everything to me because it shaped me. You know, I'm proud to come from there. You know, everyone who comes from Wigan, at the centre of everything is family and community and all the pieces like that. But also at the heart of it is the rugby, the rugby league club. And we've all been brought up supporting them, worshipping them, and either trying our best to try and represent them or support them if that's not the case.
Yeah, so rugby league, so Wigan, kind of north of England, working class largely, and then rugby league, a kind of a religion there. Is that that's the picture, is it?
I would think so, and it's strange enough, really, because, you know, we'd have players over the years come from as far as Australia, Sydney, and we all know what the beaches are like and the fun's like over there, etc. And they all seem to love it. And a lot of them actually stay there and don't go home. And I think that's just because of the community spirit and how together the town pulls in the same direction.
And then a lot happened early in life for you. So how old were you when you signed up to play rugby for Wigan?
Well, I signed as a 14-year-old. And back in the days, there was no academies, etc. So if you had signed forms to be a Wigan player, you would train with everyone together, the second team and the first team. This was before it was professional, though, but it wasn't many years until after that the game did go into professionalism. So I was quite lucky that I just caught the end of the amateur era. But as a 14-year-old, say there was, you know, five or six young players that had signed for the club, we was training with the second team and the first team on a Tuesday and a Thursday night and then going back playing for our clubs on the Saturday or Sunday, so you can imagine just what a stepping stone that was.
Yeah, hardens you up, I'd say, does it?
Well, not just hardens you up. I think it gives you belief. I suppose it's a dream come true as a Wigan supporter to be training with the likes of Ellery Hanley and Sean Edwards and Dean Bell, your heroes that you've watched for so long. And I think it fast tracks you a little bit in the sense that if you were rubbing shoulders with the greats of the game, going playing against amateur teams on a weekend, is something that you'd relish.
Yeah. How old were you when you met your wife, Colleen?
14. Yeah. 14. Everything happens at 14 and 16 in the book. Yeah. So we was. It's a small enough town, and everyone tends to know everyone. I knew of Colleen because Colleen's dad played elite rugby league for Widnes, who were the gun team at the time. And my father used to coach her younger brother Kevin, etc. Her auntie and uncle used to live over the road from me, so you're crossing paths all the time. But We went to separate schools, and we met for the first time probably properly at the age of 14.
And then, in your own words, you became a father when you were still a boy yourself. How
Oh,
old were
sorry.
you when Colleen got pregnant?
16. So,
What was that like for you both?
well, as you could imagine, you actually don't know what you don't know, really. So we didn't know any other way, really. But you knew that's not right, and that's not proper.
Was that your primary feeling, yeah?
Well,
This is not right
100%.
or proper, yeah.
It's more shame for the parents, isn't it? I would have thought, because our parents have brought us up in the right way, and
Yeah.
But how they handled it, how they supported us, how they got over the disappointment, etc., allowed us to be as normal a parents as we possibly could be at 16, 17, 18, and as teenagers, they're growing up, and me obviously having the responsibility as a father and a young rugby player who's trying to make his way into the professional game. We never missed a beat because of the support that we had, and we'll be forever thankful for that.
You do say though that there was outside of the families, there was a lot of judgment around. Colleen lost friends and that.
Well, I suppose, yeah, you go off in a different world because of the responsibilities
Yeah.
that you've got, and 100%, it was way tougher for her than it was for me, because she'd ambitions in life as well, and they was put on hold because of college or university, etc., because of us having Owen so young. But it certainly give us an appetite, a responsibility to knuckle down, and
Yeah.
I suppose knuckling down was for the two of us, of Clean being the best mother and support that she could be, and support for myself as well at the start
You
of her.
actually became a joiner, as in not,
Yeah,
as in a carpentry
it's a funny old
joiner,
story,
yeah.
because we knew that Rugby League was going to turn professional, but there was a gap there of about a year, so I needed something to tie myself over, and Colleen's dad got me a job there as a joiner for a year, and it was a fantastic experience. I loved all that. It wasn't very long though after the game went professional that you get rid of the toolbox, and I've not really looked at it since, to be honest.
Joinery's loss was rugby's gain. A big thread in the book actually is, I think, how society and rugby have evolved, and also how you've evolved within that. So, like, rugby league was a tough environment. You talk about hard work, relentless standards, being as tough as you could be. So, like, do you have to become, and I guess in Wigan as well, like, do you, is a hard man the default thing to be in that environment?
It just was in general, all those years ago, it just was in general. I mean, there was a lot of fear of failure, fear of letting people down, fear of not turning up and being good enough, because the side that I went into was full of international superstars. I mean, rugby league is a 13-man game. It had two substitutes, so a 15-man game back in the day, and Wigan had 14 internationals in that squad. So
Okay.
you can imagine,
So you were pretty
it's
hard on
dog eat dog,
yourself?
it's dog eat dog, and there was competition all over the place. So you had to be good enough, otherwise the club itself would just naturally kick you out if you wasn't, really. So and because of professionalism, we had an Australian coach, a New Zealand coach at first that I wasn't involved with, called Graham Law, who set unbelievable standards and set Wigan on the way. But my first coach was John Mawney, and he dictated like you wouldn't believe, and rightly so, because he had all these superstars trying to be top dog, and he had to be the boss, and he was.
But then you look at you now, and You would be known, I think it's fair to say, for your kind of emotional intelligence and for, you know, I won't say a sensitive soul, like, but, you know, not like some kind of, you know, dumb, hard man kind of thing. Is that an evolution that life brings?
100%. And I think if you don't feel the change, then you'll end up on your backside anyway. So from where I was then and how I was brought up through the environment that I came through, I was certainly that person for a good while. But then fast forward to where we are now, the experiences that you've had on the way, I've gone from dog eat dog, hard nose, say it as it is, even more than say it as it is, to being unbelievably positive at the other end of the scale, say 20 years later. And that positivity cannot waver, and that's the only way to be. You can't put people down, etc. So you learn along the way, I suppose.
What would you say to the young you now?
Well, I'm embarrassed by a lot of the stuff that I would have done as a captain. You know,
yeah.
As a captain, most of my career, I remember at one stage throwing a pass to someone, and the ball was dropped and went in touch. And I remember actually jumping up and down on the spot like a spoilt child, like, you know what I mean? As though, what are we doing? Our standards have been let down. I mean, wow, that's so wrong, so embarrassing, so degrading. But that was the world that we lived in then, and everyone who was trying to be successful acted like that.
That was how it was done, yeah. The attitude to injury was different back then as well. Like, the picture you paint is that you got steadily more crocked as the season went on, and you would be basically, a lot of you would be kept going by with painkiller injections towards the end of the season, yeah?
There's no doubt about that, and I'm not saying that that's right
I
at
understand.
All.
I understand,
you know?
But...
Yeah, I mean, people used to stay out of the physio room because you knew that the physio would then speak to the coach and the coach would make a decision on the back of that. So you was always playing, and still to this day, players do 100%. You're never 100% fit anyway, you know. I suppose nowadays, with professionalism and the help and the science and all the good stuff that they've got, you know, players probably play at 80% fit. But I suppose back in our day, you know, if you were 60% fit, it used to bandage you up and wobble out there, you know.
Yeah.
And that was the same within the game itself, you know.
And you wouldn't come off back then if you got a knock on the head.
Well, honest, back then it wasn't seen as something that was a big deal. It was part of playing a contact sport, and it was something that you really did get used to, you know. And it wasn't something, you know, if you could shake it off and you could manage to get through the rest of the game. That's what you did.
And were you,
we don't
are
know
you
what
up
we
there
know.
Dazed and confused, like, playing on?
Oh, there's no doubt. There's a bit of that, especially when you was playing under Friday night lights. You know, the bright lights of the stadium weren't as good as what they are today. So there were definitely times where, you know, that was part of navigating your way through a game of rugby league.
Do you worry now you might have done damage?
No, I don't at all.
You do say, I think, in the book, though, that a lot of players do worry a bit.
Well, because rightly so. I think rugby league and union is in a great spot. I've never seen as much work, as much good work be done to try and make the game as safe as it possibly can be, and I think it is as safe as it ever has been.
Yeah.
You know, I certainly applaud that, and as a coach, it would be the first thing that I would recognise, you know, because of what we know now. We didn't know back in the day.
And look, I know the connection between elite sport and motor neuron disease is kind of unclear, I suppose is how you'd put it. But I presume you watched that interview the other night with Lewis Moody, the former England captain, yeah. talking about his diagnosis of MND. I
certainly wouldn't like to go into the bones of the science behind it, because there's certainly not enough to link from what I've read anyway, but... Mm. I would just talk about the person more than anything, really. I mean, I was lucky enough to play with him for England, and what a player. I mean, his nickname was Mad Dog. That says it all, really. But what a man, what a genuinely kind-hearted man who 100% wore the shirt, whatever he played for Leicester or for England, fully committed, etc. But a family man, someone who would have been enjoying life, you know, to its fullest to this day. So we was the whole of the rugby vicinity would be absolutely devastated for him.
Yeah. So, look, you had a stellar career in rugby league, youngest ever Challenge Cup winner at 19, youngest ever test forward to play for GB, youngest ever GB captain. But then, if we jump on a bit, you finished out your time, your career, playing rugby union with Saracens and England. That was a tough time for you, was it?
Well, it was. It should have been an exciting time, because it was a hell of a leap, a big challenge, big news for all sorts of reasons. You know, a rugby league captain playing for Great Britain, coming over towards the end of his career. I was unbelievably lucky throughout my rugby league career, certainly at the beginning. I can't remember missing that many games at all, certainly for a 9-10 year period. But I suppose all the water that's gone under the bridge, really, all the
60% fit wasn't good enough.
All the
extra
training and you know, stuff that was done away from the club, you know, trying to stay ahead of the game, keep yourself topped up, and you know, trying to get the edge. All that, I suppose, it takes its toll eventually. And you know, you look at players these days, and you know, 33, 34, some of them are still as bright as ever, really. Yeah. But I think it's the years that's gone into you. You know, if you're starting your career at 23, 24, 25, then, you know, the longevity will take you to that space. For me, I've been playing professional sport from 16 years of age, and always chasing the dream. And it catches up with you. And
You also said you were never comfortable in your skin as a rugby union player.
No,
was that about moving south and like?
I moved south because that was the fantastic challenge that we wanted.
Yeah,
as a family, you know, we could have move sports into rugby union and still had an unbelievable challenge, you know, whether you move just down the road there from Wigan to Leicester or to Northampton, etc. And we decided to go to Saracens, North London, and that was as much as out of our comfort zone as you could possibly imagine. Not just for me, you know, obviously the challenge and the scrutiny would have all been on me, but it was the challenge for us as a family as well. And you know, the rugby union part of the career, you rightly say, was an unbelievable challenge, not just because of the injuries now, but because probably it didn't suit my style of play. I was a loose forward in rugby league, and to learn a number eight position later on in your career, or number six position, there was too much to do in too little of time. So they decided that playing number 12 centre for rugby union would have been easier, and I agree it was easier, but I wasn't at number 12. I wasn't quick enough, you know. I wasn't that type of player, realistically. So I suppose when you're playing rugby league from such a young age, when you get to elite level, you're playing on instinct from the stuff that you've done all your life. And then when you're trying to learn a new sport,
you're having to think.
And once you're having to think, then you're not quite with it.
So they very generously switched you into the coaching side of things for the remainder of your career. And that baby that you had as a boy, at that stage, is Owen Farrell, and you're coaching him. You think you were quite hard on him?
I would have thought so. You know, I from my experience, from what I've seen from the amateur games on the touchlines on a Saturday or Sunday morning, you know, I know that everyone's different, but I suppose if you're coaching your son, you've got to look at it both ways. Are you being too easy, because that's not right for the rest of the parents or the rest of the team. So I think I was more the other way, you know, harsh and examples and, you know, all of that. I don't think that's fair neither, really. So getting that balance right is hard as a Sunday morning amateur parent who's coaching. So I didn't tend to do that as much. Obviously, I had a playing career, but when Owen was coming into the academy at 15, 16 at Saracens, that's when I first started coaching. So I suppose we've not really known any different.
It hasn't been easy for him being your son in lots of ways. People would be semi-aware of some of it. So you talk about the abuse you got back in the rugby league days, like, and it was dog's abuse.
You weren't getting dog's abuse, then you was probably doing something wrong.
Okay. And then Owen used to get abuse for being your son, basically, then when he started out,
I get that as well, like, you know, because in a working class environment, some people have got dreams of their sons making it for St Helens or Widnes or Warrington or Leeds or whatever. They've got aspirations for their sons to do well, and, you know, I suppose to do that, they just want a stage, and I suppose when you've got a professional rugby league player on the side watching his son or whatever, then it's probably a moment that they're waiting for. I'm not saying it's right, but this is rife now in the working class game of football, and, you know, we understand that, you know, if parents go to Man United now, they're not even to watch their sons. They're not even allowed to say a word, like, you know, because of the desperation, I would have thought, to try and get the motivation within their sons to come through and be the superstar that they want them to be.
Okay. And, of course, people will know Owen stepped back after the World Cup. Owen stepped back from international rugby, without getting into the full story of it, that was essentially kind of an abuse situation as well, I guess, was part of it, wasn't it?
I think that was part of it. You know, the scrutiny, all of that.
That hard for you then as his dad?
Oh, he's brutal. More for his mum, I would have thought, for my wife. Like, you know, I mean, you know, every mother, the sons never grow up, really. You know, so it's never nice. I mean, you know, I've been involved as a professional player or coach most of my life, so I get all that, like, you know, there was a lot, I would have thought, that was going on in his mind, and perfect storm building up, and understand why it came to that and whether you needed it or not. I suppose he'd done okay, 112 caps I think it is for England, had an unbelievable career to that point. So I suppose he felt he deserved a bit of a break.
I was interested. So when you coached the Lions this year, Owen joined the squad subsequently. You had asked him at the start.
I hadn't asked him. we obviously have a coaching panel, and
yeah.
This is a tough old process now, because it's everyone's dream to get picked for the British and Irish Lions. So we had a thorough process over a good amount of months.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm not suggesting it was
no,
your
I
decision
know,
to
I know
ask him.
Not,
yeah.
I know,
but I think you were the one who ended
well,
up saying
well, the squad was picked,
and
we got
and
down.
His...
We got down to the final. We got down to the final selection, and we was all glad to get to that point.
Yeah,
you know, because,
and what was Owen's reaction?
Well, I said, listen, that's okay, I was doing that, but I need to make a phone call because I don't know what his reaction is going to be. And he didn't want to do it. He wasn't up for it. He felt on many levels that it wasn't right. You know, he'd had a bit of concussion which was dying down and would have been, because we're still 6 weeks away or whatever from the tour. I think more the scrutiny on him, but also on me, what he didn't feel was.
But he was quite
where
upset
he
about
to be.
That too.
Well, he was because it's everyone's dream to do that, and not nice, but it's part of life, isn't it? And here we are.
Yeah. Yeah, must have been hard for you as well.
It was very hard, because when somebody's turning down that type of an opportunity, then there's a lot of thinking, that deep thinking that goes into that, isn't there?
Yeah. So come here. What was it like coming to Ireland for you? Because so you're an English icon, right? Rooted in Wigan, as we discussed earlier. An Irish name and Irish kind of Irishy background. Owen was playing for England. Your youngest son Gabriel, I guess,
Gabriel,
at this stage is Irish, right? You seem settled. How do you reconcile all this? Is here home for you now?
Oh, it certainly is. We're 10 years here now, living here, and we love it. As you say, you settle into life wherever you are. You try and make a home, but it's been very easy to do that here. Obviously, life goes on, normality, school for Gabriel. We've had one of our daughters live with us, and then move back. Our other daughter Gracie is with us now, and working over here. So. It's a great place to live, and we've enjoyed every single. I actually can't believe it's 10 years. It's flown by.
Yeah, so it is home.
Well, it is. 100%.
I've kind of been watching you and your leadership styles. It's very interesting. I think a lot of people just pick up these little clues and things you say, and they go, "That's interesting." So if we start with one of the big things you wanted. The team to do was to be themselves, right? Except Johnny Sexton.
Well, I think when you and there's a handful of people like this who are so driven, like, you know, and what's at the heart of it is they're desperate to be successful and to win, and sometimes I think. Because I was like that.
Yeah.
Desperation to me, you think it's a great thing, but at the elite level, it can get in the way. It can get in the way of your emotions and thinking straight and all of that. So learning how to be a great leader, it takes time. It takes time to understand that everyone's not as driven as you, and everyone's completely different. And I certainly learned that very quickly when I went into coaching from playing. As a player, you're a team player, but you don't understand until you get into coaching that you go home, you recover, you look after yourself, you get your nutrition right. A lot of it's about you making sure that you're in the best nick to be able to give yourself to the team. But when you get into coaching, you realise that there's 50 other blokes that think completely different to you, and you know, all this weird and wonderful stuff coming together is what makes team sport. So you've got to understand everyone. I understand that everyone's not as driven in the same way, but that doesn't mean that they don't want to be part of a successful team. So it's finding a way. It's finding a way. And, you know...
And how do you do that? Is part of it would seem to be the simple version of the story, is that you have made the environment a more relaxed, open kind of...
Listen, don't get me wrong. As we say in the book that... As we was talking about at the top of the show there, from where I started at Wigan,
yeah,
to where I finished playing at Saracens, you know, I think the sweet spot somewhere in the middle is just being honest and truthful to people so they understand, for good or bad, you know, people don't like hearing bad news, but as long as they know it's coming from the right place. And that right place is that you're only trying to help them be the best player or best person that they can be. So therefore, if they 100% believe that that's your motive, then there's trust that grows, isn't there? You know, this isn't, again, it isn't happy clappy, and you know it sometimes when it gets written down that it's a great place to be. It's not. It's tough. It's challenging. You go through all these ups and downs together. But I suppose when at the heart of that, all you're trying to do is help each other to grow that team together. Is a special place to be.
Was that new to them?
I suppose, I don't know. You would have to ask them, but I learned pretty early in my coaching career that you know, we all want to go around the world and learn new tricks, how to be a better coach, you know, better at your job or whatever it may be. But I came to the conclusion pretty quickly that, you know, if you're trying to be something that you're not, or trying to be someone else, then that authenticity is completely lost. So I suppose I'm only trying to do it my way, like, you know, and yeah. I think that's more comfortable for everyone that you're trying to portray your stuff to.
Yeah, yeah. You talk about in the book, words that always stayed with you: trust yourself to be yourself. And I think that's something then you do with them as well. You talk about trusting the players to be decision makers in the situation. I've noted you saying at times when someone made a decision that led to a bad outcome, I've seen you say afterwards, no, he made the right decision in that moment, right? So I guess that comes, it's kind of like in life, is it? So you be in the moment and you play the game that's in front of you. Yeah,
and it sounds simple, but yeah. It's not, because yeah. there are a good 20 or 30 different pictures that you're taking in that split second, you know. But putting yourself in those type of situations over and over again, constantly within training and driving those type of standards, allow people to make better decisions along the way.
Okay, so again, that it's about instinct.
It's about instinct. It's about understanding. It's about feel of the whole situation that's in front of you.
And again, was that different for them? Were they coming from a more regimented environment?
No. I mean, Joe is. I learned so much under Joe, and I still think to this day he's the best coach that Ireland's ever had or gone to ever have. I mean, the foundations that he set there were unbelievable. And you know, you 100% take all the good and keep it there. We still do a lot of stuff that Joe put into the DNA of Irish rugby. But at the same time, then you have to be yourself and add your twist to that.
I suppose fundamentally what I'm asking is being relaxed actually the better way to be if you're in a high performance stressful situation?
Well, yeah.
Are you better being relaxed than keyed up?
I wouldn't say relaxed, because relaxed seems a little bit horizontal
yeah,
for me.
Okay.
I do think there's a sweet spot there in as far as being in control of your emotions, because we're playing an emotional game, like, you know. It's a combat sport, plenty of collisions. It's going to hurt, but that's what we sign up to do because we love the thrill of that, you know. I suppose if you're only because I've seen it. If you're raging before a game and you're punching the toilet door off and it's off its hinges, then from my evidence, you're going to be absolutely drained by 10 minutes into the game. So how are you going to get people to make good decisions for 80, 85 minutes plus if you're not in control of your emotions? It's a big part of how the games move forward.
Another interesting thing was that amidst that disappointment of being knocked out of the World Cup in 2023, Johnny Sexton got a little bit of criticism for saying that he achieved what he set out to do. But it turned out that the goal was, I think the goal you set for your whole time is inspire the nation. The goal is not necessarily as simple as, well, you want to win matches and everything.
I think inspiring the nation of people of Ireland being proud of their team for all sorts of reasons, role models, the type of rugby that they play, how they make the them feel when they're watching them, whether they're getting behind them, etc. To me, that's bigger than winning any single game. And I was brought up, that's all that mattered, winning. And it really does matter, you know. But I think if there's something that's bigger than that, it's powerful. It binds people together more. It gives people a purpose, you know. And, you know, we was unbelievably proud of how well the country combined together. I think, you know, it still gives you goosebumps, that World Cup. I think Ireland in general, I'm talking the rugby team and the people, the fans, lit up the World Cup in France. And I think, obviously, I would say this because I was involved, but I thought we was the envy of most countries as far as how the support and the team did it together.
Okay, I'd say there isn't a dry eye around the country listening to that. We'll finish on those inspiring words. The Only Way I Know, it's published by Sandy Cove on Thursday. It's a terrific book. Well done, Andy. By the way, why is it called The Only Way I Know?
We was writing the book and stumbling many a times on a name. And Gavin Marzer, who has been brilliant throughout the couple of years that we've been doing this together, who helped me write the book, he said it's obvious that this is what you keep on saying the whole time. Like, okay. You know what I mean? So
yeah. Okay. And Andy, you'll be in conversation with Joe Malloy at the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre tomorrow night as well.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. Andy Farrell, thank you very much. Terrific.
Cheers, Brendan. Thank you.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.